Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
Today, we're going to talk about writing as a career, what that looks like. I think aside from, you know, that picture we paint in our mind of a writer in a cabin with a sweater on and, you know, a fall setting and whatnot.
There's a lot of hot cocoa.
Yes.
On tap.
Yes.
Or you're in a hammock.
Yes.
And you're in Miami and you can hear the gulls.
Yes.
And every now and then, like this kind of funny mood strikes you, so you roll out of the hammock and type something,
and then go back.
But then you
on your drink,
yeah, and then you head out on your paddleboard, and
yeah. So I assume that's exactly what it's like. Then
it is exactly what it's like.
How many typewriters do you own?
I don't have any typewriters. Yeah. When I was in college, I had a word processor, which was the closest thing to not writing on Word.
Yes.
You know, not a computer.
Yeah.
But yeah. There are zero typewriters. There are lots of keyboards, though.
I want to talk about your team. Right. I think a lot of times when we think about writing as a career, it is you by yourself doing your thing. And there's a lot of truth to that. Right. A lot of what you do is independent and on your own. But you would not have a successful career as a writer without your team. So why don't we start with your agent, Simon?
So the key guy for a professional writer is to have a really good agent, I think. You know, like I don't think you're going to find a successful professional actor that doesn't have a good agent. I don't think you're going to find a successful professional writer who doesn't have a good agent. If they do, they are an anomaly, right? Like, and if they do, it's because they have the skills of an agent.
Right.
Right. Like if they have those skills, maybe they could do it. But even if they have those skills, there's some power in having someone independent from you negotiating on your behalf and heralding you and building you up. Right.
Yeah. Not only that, but time as well. Like, do you want to spend your time writing or do you want to spend your time pushing your book?
Right.
Right. Like, every moment you spend doing the agent's job is a moment you're not doing your own job.
Exactly. Right. And it's much like the issue that someone faces if they go into self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, you are an author and a publisher, so make sure you're ready for both jobs, right? Yeah. Like, and those are big jobs. A publisher usually has a team doing that job, right? When I was a young writer, when I was just starting out, I did my first couple negotiations and my first couple contracts unagented.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I did that was because I had approached agents and just hadn't found one and found an interested publisher before I found an interested agent. And probably having an interested publisher on the line, I could have worked it out with an agent probably if I'd known then what I know now.
I assume most agents, if you said, hey, do you want to represent me? Oh, and I've got a book deal that I need you to make money on.
Yeah, I've got a bag of free money. I wanted to give away 15% of it.
Yeah.
Like,
and any takers?
You'll find some takers. But even so, it might be hard to get a top agent, you know, even unless it's quite the deal, you know, quite a lot of money being offered. In the case of my first deal with Fablehaven, my advance was $0. Mm-hmm. And that's a little less sexy.
Right.
To approach, hey, you know, you can get 15% of nothing.
Yeah.
And we may make something after we print it up, you know, and it's like, okay, well, that doesn't make you too special yet.
Right.
But because I hadn't found an agent at first, yeah, I could have had a better negotiated deal, I think, with Fablehaven Book One. And it is what it is.
Tell me a little bit about Simon, who he is and all that.
Let me tell you kind of how I got Simon.
Mm-hmm. How you tricked Simon into being your agent.
Yeah. There reached a point where Fablehaven had come out. We'd published two books. When Book Two came out, it actually hit on the New York Times list. And this was partly because of some very aggressive, smart marketing that my sister did for me.
Mm-hmm.
And some really hard grassroots marketing that Shadow Mountain supported. And it kind of surprised everybody that this book hit the New York Times list. It wasn't supposed to. In general, New York knows what books are going to hit the list.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly I had a lot more attention because this book came out of nowhere and hit the New York Times list. And Fablehaven had sold fairly well, the first one. And I had some mentoring early in my career from an author named Orson Scott Card.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had had someone approach me with some interest in movie stuff, and I turned to him and said, hey, what do I do about this? And he put me in contact with his agent for book to movie deals out in Hollywood.
Oh, cool.
And when I got in contact with that guy...
Which is a different agent than what you'd use for representing your books.
It is a totally different agent. There's mm-hmm. There are agents who specialize in selling your books to the entertainment industry mm-hmm. or to Hollywood. And so this guy was a guy named Matthew Snyder at mm-hmm. Creative Artist Agency. And he's an important piece of the puzzle, and he still represents my stuff for that purpose, right? But he was very surprised when he found out I didn't have a literary agent yet. Mm-hmm. And so he set up meetings for me with three literary agents in New York. And I had been sending many queries to agents.
So you're saying it's more common to start with a literary agent than an entertainment agent. You did this backwards.
He knew it was backwards. He thought it was almost funny. Mm-hmm. So like with someone from inside the system saying, hey, will you look at this guy? Suddenly I had three very top agents. Mm-hmm. Like all three of these agents would have been terrific, would have been sort of out of my league a year before, right? And one of them was Simon Lipscar. And when I even waffled a little bit between two guys that both seemed really great. And when I told him who the other guy was, he was like, most of the people you could have said, I would have been insulted. He's like, but that guy's actually pretty great. and so he was, and still even so, like Simon just kind of stood out. He just seemed like this beautiful mix of really savvy and really smart. And he was with a really strong organization called Writer's House, which, mm-hmm. you know, had done so many big novels. And he had personally represented the Aragon series, which had done really, really mm-hmm. well. And so it was like, I could get the same agent as Christopher Paolini. And he is this big up-and-comer in Writer's House and ended up becoming like the president of Writer's House. Mm-hmm. And so it was a great horse to bet on. And I felt really lucky that I got him. And now, after having worked with him for many years, I think I wouldn't have nearly as good a career had I not had him as my agent.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me, I know one thing you mentioned, one thing that you really like about Simon is his age. How does that play into you and your career?
Yeah, it was one of the things I liked was that he was around my age. And with him being around my age, it just said, he'll be doing this for a while. And mm-hmm. I mean to be doing this for a while. Mm-hmm. And even one of the things I early on asked him was, do you see yourself doing this for a while? And he almost like, he was like laughing because, you know, he's this very successful agent. And so to him, he's like, yeah, this is my career, my friend. You know what I mean? But it was also like, I was trying to do long-term planning. Like I hope to be doing this for 30 years. Like, are you the kind of guy that loves this and will be doing it
and for 30 years? And can be my partner for 30 years.
Yeah. And so far it's been almost 20. So it's been good. And yeah, like as a young writer, I didn't at first even fully understand what an agent would bring to the table. Mm-hmm. But part of the thinking I had to do for understanding what an agent will bring is, okay, A, the very fundamental thing is an agent will take about 15% of the sale that they make for you. And on foreign, they'll take about 20%.
Yeah.
That's ballpark numbers.
And those are big numbers too.
Yeah. I mean, like, let's say I got $1 million contract mm-hmm. for a 5-book series, a giant advance, right? Yeah. Which has happened a couple of times for me, something in that neighborhood, only when it's been multiple books.
Sure.
That would mean $150,000 will go to the agent, right?
Yeah.
And that's 15%. That's a lot of money, mm-hmm. right? And if he can make me a deal that'll get $1 million and me on my own, I would have gotten a deal for $500,000. I'd be really glad I used an agent,
right?
And so the question from the start is, can this agent make me pay for themselves by making me more than 15% of what I could do without them? Mm-hmm. And in Simon's case, that's always been true.
Yeah, 100% of the time, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think 100% of the time he has gotten me significantly more money than I could have gotten on my own. And has been this advocate in my corner as things have to be renegotiated or things have to be added onto. He almost mm-hmm. likes when negotiations are complicated mm-hmm. because it's more challenging for him. And there's more moving parts for him to finagle with and tinker with. And for me, like, for example, with Fablehaven, we had Shadow Mountain, who was publishing the hardcover, but Simon & Schuster was publishing the softcover. And that was already quite out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. And intriguing to him of how you could maybe get two publishers working for you and generate more than either could have done on their own. Like, that kind of stuff is intriguing to him, interesting to him. Then a whole nother component of what an agent does is, like, at least an agency like Writer's House, they will sell my foreign rights. Mm-hmm. And for foreign rights, they're asking 20%. For domestic, they do about 15%. But when they sell my foreign rights, there was a really good chance Czechoslovakia was never going to write me a check for anything ever in my life. And I would not know who to approach or who to, but they have all the contacts to go, well, you know, Czechoslovakia or whatever, right? The Czech Republic. I don't think that's Czechoslovakia is a country anymore.
So maybe, let's talk about a country that is relevant to your stuff, which is Poland, right? Like you do quite well in Poland.
Yeah.
So that would be, you would have $0 from Poland or
probably
80% of what you actually got. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Poland is like, every now and then you'll have a foreign country where your books do really well. A mix of, they are taking over the job of translating it. They're taking it over the job of marketing it. Like they're worrying about everything. I would not know where to look to find these people.
Right.
In Poland, I ended up with a great translator, a guy named Rafał. And I ended up with publishers that pushed it hard. Fable Haven became required reading in Polish schools. Mm-hmm. When I'd go out to Poland, I would have big lines at my signings and people were really excited about it. And it was just almost shocking because I'd never done any seed planting there myself. I had done no work there. And so it was amazing to see that, oh, wow, like that would have never happened if I didn't have an agent representing this stuff to foreign countries. And so, yeah, I mean, Poland has made lots of money for me, like tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands over the years. And it's like, yeah, you can have 20% of that,
which would have
been zero. Like if all they did was the foreign sales, it would be worth having.
What else does an agent do? It sounds like they're selling your book, both foreign and domestic, right? Are they the ones that are going to different publishers and pitching this book to the publishers? Is that their main role? What do you see the agent's kind of main role there?
Yeah, so the agent is most of the vetting of what unpublished authors or the vetting of books that are out there, like what would be worth publishing. Much of the vetting has been delegated to the agents, right? So versus going through their slush piles in-house, which some publishers still do, but a lot of them trust that the agents will be going through the slush piles. And so the agent's reputation is based on, hey, when I bring you something, it's good, right? So they are very motivated to only pick good stuff so that they'll be seen as legitimate.
So going back in time, you know, we talked about earlier on an earlier episode, you mentioned how you sent out your first manuscript and to a bunch of publishers and you got zero response. Nobody said anything. Nobody even said no, right? There was nothing. And so part of that is because you were sending this out and not an agent that they have a relationship with and a track record with.
Yeah. So an agent that they know and respect will get your stuff seen immediately and you'll get an answer quick. And also their interest goes up with the quality of the agent, right? If an agent has a really strong track record, they're immediately interested just because that agent's judgment has been proven to be sound, right? And so having a good agent really helps your stuff get seen and get treated like it's legitimate. And then you've got that agent working as an advocate for you to point out, you know, what the opportunities are with you as an author, with the book. A good agent is helping you plan your career, and they're helping you think through what's the next book and where should it be, what's strategically the best relationships to build. And if you've been having a good relationship with Simon and Schuster, then yeah, we should keep nourishing that relationship. And if you've got a good relationship with Shadow Mountain, then yeah, keep nourishing that relationship. If there's a new opportunity at a new publisher like Scholastic, And that might bring something new to the equation, then yeah, maybe we bring in, you know, we try something with a new publisher. And so those kind of career choices, those can be hard to navigate if you don't really know the industry. And some of these agents, I mean, that's what they do for a living, is they pay attention to this industry. They know the main players and they think through how do we build a career for this writer.
Right? How much of a role how much of a role do they play in editing for you? How big of a voice do they have? Because they're not your editor, right? And we'll get to that role in a second, but what role do they play as far as editing goes?
That's going to vary based on the agent. But with me and Simon, Simon reads almost everything that I write and pretty much all the novels, right? And he will give me, he's some of the first early feedback. Sometimes he's working with my editor on some of the feedback. They'll check their notes against each other because he's just good sound judgment. I mean, the job description for an agent is you must have good creative judgment. And this is the kind of person that you want feedback from, right? And I've never had what I would call bad feedback from Simon. In fact, I've almost only had really good feedback from Simon. When I say not necessarily positive feedback, but intelligent feedback, accurate, usable, worthwhile feedback. And so he brings a lot of value with just giving me feedback on the manuscript. He brings the value of getting the manuscript in front of decision makers and encouraging them and using some of his clout to bring those advances up to a place that lets me make a good living as a writer. The advance is guaranteed money, right? It's money that you get paid up front. You then have to earn it back through royalties, right? But the advance, getting a good advance, lets you know at the start of the project, I'm getting paid, right?
Yeah. One of the things, seeing you and Simon work together, one of the things that struck me about Simon is he is not a yes man for you. How important is it to you that he doesn't play that role of, yeah, whatever you want, Brandon, we'll do. But that he's not afraid to tell you no. He's not afraid to help steer and direct you. He's not afraid to step in and help you make the best choices for your career.
Yeah, he is trying very hard to be the voice of reality. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly useful. I mean, you know this. I mean, what do we want for emotional ease? Mm-hmm. We want a yes man.
Yeah.
What do we want for creative success? We want someone who will really contribute and ask the hard questions so that hopefully some of the hardest questions get asked and answered before the general public gets to weigh in, right? I want the thing I put out there to already be in pretty good shape so that I don't have to get my bad feedback from lousy book sales and lousy opinions of the book, right? And so it's much better to endure some of those hard conversations with an editor or an agent instead of having it be in part of the public forum of the readerships of the English language or multiple languages, right?
Yeah. I know you love working with Simon. You have all intention in the world of being with Simon your whole career.
Yeah.
How common is that? How often are authors jumping from agent to agent, and or do some authors have multiple agents for different projects and different novels in different categories?
Your goal with an agent is to have a long-term relationship. Mm-hmm. That's your goal. Mm-hmm. And like any long-term relationship, if it goes bad, you might want to go somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. With Simon, I don't have a thing that fully binds me to him. Like, it's largely a handshake, and we go from book deal to book deal. And every book deal, he gets his piece, but it's not like, your next 10 books are mine. Like he's confident enough that he's good at what he does that we work from book to book. And he's like, hey, if you ever want to leave me, what I ask is have a conversation with me and explain it to me.
Tell me to my face.
Yeah. But like, it's so healthy, right? And, and you've got some agents out there who might be trying to bind you down for lots of books. And I would say, be careful of that. You might have agents out there who want you to pay them to be your agent. I don't pay Simon a dime out of my own money to be my agent. Everything he makes is commissions off sales he does.
Yeah.
And to me, that seems great because his motivation is, hey, I don't get paid unless you get paid, right? And if someone is getting paid to be your agent, then they've already got their paycheck, right? Like without selling anything for you. And so I would say, you know, anyone be wary of someone like that. The industry is not set up where you pay your agent out of your pocket. Your agent should be paid from commissions. If someone's doing less than that, they're probably not much of an agent, just to be frank.
Yeah. Kind of a nuts and bolts question. When you get your paychecks, are you getting it from Simon's company or from the publishers? Like, are the publishers paying Simon's company and then Simon's company is taking, it's Writer's House, right? It is like Simon & Schuster or Penguin or whoever, are they paying Writer's House and then Writer's House cuts you a check, or does it work the other way?
Yeah, the money comes to me through the agent. So they take their cut right off the top. And that's also kind of nice because they're overseeing the practical side of am I getting paid and is it the right amount and does it match the contract? And like they're kind of looking at that stuff before the money gets to me. So I really don't have to worry about that side of the job.
So they're kind of an accountant on top of everything else for you then.
They're watching over the business side of my job and making sure that things are getting paid and making especially the most important thing is negotiating the deals and going over the contracts and making sure that everything makes sense from a professional standpoint.
Yep. I assume Simon's working with a team as well. So what other roles would you guess are going on that maybe people that are working for Simon and indirectly for you that you may not have met or known or anything else? Anything on the agent side where there's other people working for your betterment and good that you might not even have a relationship with?
So in Rider's House, there are people who are primarily for foreign deals, and that's not Simon, right? So he's got...
He doesn't speak Turkish and is...
He's got agents he collaborates with who will do most of the foreign selling, and he will go out to like some of the foreign book fairs, and he takes a degree of interest in selling certain things foreign, but only at the very kind of high level,
right?
And at a conference situation or things like that. For day-to-day selling to foreign markets, there's agents who specialize in that. And if it were that I started heavily doing picture books, let's say, that might not be his thing. He might recommend me to a different agent inside of Rider's House who is more focused and dialed in on picture books, right?
Right.
He's represented a couple picture books for me because I've never done it's never been a major emphasis in my career. So he'll do that. But the time when you might have a different agent is if you started doing a lot of work in a category that wasn't their wheelhouse, they might be like, well, this makes sense to do that with him or with her because it's not my wheelhouse.
Awesome. All right, let's move on from agents. They sound like a super important part of your team.
Yes.
Let's talk about on the publishing side. It seems like for all of your books, one of the most important people that you have, if not the most important person on your team, is your editor helping you with that. I know two of your editors, Chris and Lisa, both amazing at what they do. Talk to me a little bit about, let's start with Chris because he was your first editor. Tell me a little bit about Chris, your relationship with Chris, what role he plays on your team, and then we'll do the same with Lisa.
Yeah, well, Chris is interesting. The role he plays at Shadow Mountain, I mean, strictly speaking, he's probably the publisher or the head of the creative side of the company. And then also he does work as kind of the first editor of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a second editor. For years and years and years, it was Emily Watts at Deseret Book, who was some of the more nuts and bolts editing as well. But Chris would do a lot of the big picture edits at first, like just making sure that which is the first thing that any editor does, right? Like your first edit you get back is like an editorial letter about global issues for the book, pacing in certain chapters, if certain characters are working or not. Like, you know, its emphasis is usually on what's a little broken, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the hardest thing you get back from a publisher is that first editorial letter where you get explained, like, here's some of the biggest problems we have in this series. And you get a chance to take a crack at the big problems first.
Yeah.
And so no one's haggling over commas at first. Mm-hmm. Like that's not even, it's haggling over, is this story worth telling?
Yeah.
Is it told in a way that's
engaging?
Should
this character even be in here?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, is it working? Right. And where is it kind of not working? And so you start out with really broad strokes. And Chris would look at that stuff. And Lisa, who works at Simon & Schuster, would definitely look at that stuff. And then you go from there and you narrow down and narrow down and narrow down.
Does it switch to a different person when it comes to more that fine-tooth comb stuff of like punctuation and spelling and specific words? Or are these people that you're working with, Chris and Lisa, are they just totally adept at all of that, that they're great at both those things?
Chris and Lisa and Emily are all very adept at periods and commas and stuff.
But not semicolons.
But yeah, semicolons get really hard. They get confusing. Yeah. They're confusing
for most editors.
All of us.
Yeah.
There is a copy editor. There's someone. Mm-hmm. There's someone who is the mathematician of the book world, who specifically knows this Simon & Schuster style guide, and even down to they make a customized style guide for each author for some of the nuances of where they like to deviate from the rules. For example, this author really likes to turn certain nouns into verbs.
Mm-hmm.
And when we call them on it, it's always deliberate. And we're just going to say that's part of their voice. That's part of their fingerprint. So if they turn a noun into a verb that's not technically a verb yet in the dictionary, we're not going
to. This author is allowed to do that because that's part of their.
It's part of their style. It's what they prefer, right? And it's part of the language evolving, right? And so like for me, I know at Simon & Schuster, they've got a big, fat style guide for Brandon Mole books, right?
What are some of the fun things that like has for you that would be like a red flag for another author, because it's like, hey, you don't typically do this, so let's continue not doing this. That
nouns into verbs is one of them. Yeah. Sometimes I'll cheat and use nouns as verbs. And there's, I would have to get out the guide to get all the minutia, but sometimes it's just, you have quirks. Like one of my quirks is I don't like semicolons. Mm-hmm. If I can do a dash instead of a semicolon, I always want to do the dash, even if it's not, if a semicolon's perfect and a dash is almost perfect, I want the dash.
Yeah.
You know, if a dash is just dead wrong, then okay, I don't want the dash. Right. But I would take a dash over a semicolon. I just like, my eyes like it better, right? And there might be just little eccentricities on how you like to use commas or liberties you take when you're inside a character speaking, like for character voice, we might have this character deliberately be grammatically incorrect.
Right.
And lots of little things like that. If there's patterns, they will try to identify those patterns. And sometimes they're patterns I don't even know I have.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, often I think they are patterns I don't know I have, but it's just part of my voice, my fingerprints as an author. And they're like,
is it fun to look at that style guide and go, huh, I guess I do that.
Those things that I named. Yeah. Like some of those came to my attention only because of the feedback. Right. I was like, oh, I didn't realize that I was sometimes just totally turning nouns into verbs in ways that weren't technically correct.
Now, you describe this style guide, right? And in the industry I work in, we have style guides, and it's more colors and other stuff that we're fonts and things that we're dealing with. And I'm sure you have style guides
because you're doing film.
Yeah, for film and whatnot. But I'm sure that, like, when you say pages and pages, have you actually seen the document? Is it like a Word document, or is it a big thing? Is it something that you have flipped through and gone, huh? Or is it something like, that's not... out of sight, out of mind. I don't need to worry about that.
I've looked at it online. It's about 50 pages. And I've looked at it online. And yeah, I didn't dig in super deep, almost in the sense of like, you don't want to make yourself too self-conscious.
Right.
Almost, you know, right. You just want to be like, if I've got my quirks, I'll let them be my quirks. Like if it's like a story Bible to keep a universe straight, that'll look at, right? Because I'm trying to keep my universe straight.
And who's keeping track of your story Bibles? Who does that? Is that the publisher as well?
Often an editor will keep one, yeah, as the editor is trying to keep the story straight and make sense of my weird story world I made up. Most of the time for me, the story Bible's kind of in my head. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about it long enough that I kind of know the world. But like that, sometimes it's harder if I go back to an old series that I wrote a bunch of years ago. Then I'm like, wait a minute, I remember most of it, but I can't remember, what did I do?
Because you had a long break between Candy Shop War 2 and 3. Right.
That's a good example.
So you might have had to go. Was there a physical, not a physical, but a document that you looked at where somebody else wrote the story Bible for Candy Shop War, and you went, okay, I get these people now?
There were a couple things I looked at like that. And like when I did the Dragon Watch series, I hired my sister-in-law to create a Fablehaven story Bible. Mm-hmm. And like stuff like that, just so that I would have a refresher course on some of the details. Like anything like that is good, right? Like I try so hard to keep it all in my head, but when enough time's gone by, there's minutia and details that you just, at least for me, I haven't been able to hold on to. So it's good to go back to story Bibles. But part of what an editor is trying to do is their main job is trying to make the story work, right? An editor's job, when an editor really understands their job, and the pros all do, they're trying to help you realize your vision in a way that makes sense in the best way possible. And so they really are, they're on your side, and they are not trying to turn it into their book. Like they are trying to make your book as good as it can be. And sometimes that's being sensitive to certain societal norms and some, you know, evolving things in the culture. Like sometimes the editors will be like, okay, that's now becoming an offensive word to use. So we don't want to use that. If you say the character made a crazy choice, there's a thing with ableism where we're worried about labeling choices as crazy because of it gets into foggy areas.
And so you want to use words like wild or whatever instead of.
Yeah. And it's like, that wasn't on my radar yet.
Yeah.
You know, and editors help you track that kind of thing. And, you know, because my goal is to tell a fun story. I'm not trying to offend everybody, right? And so if there's easy things you can do to not offend everybody or hurt people's feelings, then, yeah, you try to do them in general. And the editor is also trying to just make sure that the story is coherent and works, right? And so to have somebody on your side trying to do that, and it's somebody with really good professional creative judgment, I mean, it makes them an invaluable resource. Your editor usually gets assigned to you by your publisher. Mm-hmm. You know, if when you make a publishing deal, they will assign you to an editor. I was assigned to Lisa at Simon & Schuster, and I still am really loyal to her because she's a terrific editor. And so, I hope to keep working with her for years to come.
And you've moved publishers as she's moved publishers too, right? Tell me a little bit about that relationship with Lisa and how strong that is, that you would actually consider different publishers because of your relationship with your editor.
Yeah, I had a really long, effective relationship at Simon & Schuster. But the face of that relationship was Lisa, my editor. Mm-hmm. And there were other people at that publisher that were very supportive. And over time, a lot of those people move around mm-hmm. to different publishers. And so some of the team that I knew best and was most supportive at Simon & Schuster went off to different places. And then when Lisa went to a different place, it was just more familiar to work with that editor. And so for my new series, we pitched it first to her over at Random House because that was a relationship I wanted to preserve, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's awesome. Any other things that we should know about editors and the role that they play in the process?
The role with an editor, it's almost always painful. Mm-hmm. Reading that first letter back from an editor where you thought you turned in your best work and you'd already rewritten it 10 times yourself.
And I know you pride yourself on turning in a really polished first draft.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But what they see first, I want them to take something great and make it better than mm-hmm. take something fair and make it good. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm trying to give them the very best I got because I know no matter how good it is, they're going to find ways to improve it.
Right.
That's what they do. Right. And so if I give them, I've already smelted some of the gold out of the ore, mm-hmm. then they can work on refining the gold instead of smelting the gold out, right? And so I want it to be really good work. And so it's always so hard to get that first editorial letter where you see, oh man, I had some big blind spots and there's some stuff that'll take some real work to improve and change that I wish I saw earlier and I could have written it that way the first time. And you really wrestle with it. So I try to give myself 3 days to absorb what's been shared, because as I absorb it, it's almost always of course, this is going to make it better and it's all good advice. But sometimes it stings at first. You know what I mean? It's painful at first. Another thing that has been useful is that editors are almost always pretty right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're usually pretty right. And you just have to learn to be a little bit humble. Mm-hmm. And unless it's something that you really care about so much and that there's just something that they didn't see that meant the world to you, most of the time their advice is just pretty good. I mean, there's a reason that they're doing it. If you're working with an editor at a big publisher, there's usually a reason they're doing it at a high level. And so you put a lot of stock in what they say, you put a lot of trust in what they say. And so far, in a lot of ways, Lisa and the different editors have been kind of a guiding star for me. On each book where that book or that series wouldn't have been what it was if I had been working with a different editor.
Yeah. Tell me, who else on the publishing team is critical to your success? I know that's a dumb statement, but there's other roles in there besides just the editors.
So if I was naming two, agent and editor are really good two to name. Mm-hmm. Pretty high up on that is then you've got a designer.
Mm-hmm.
And the designer is going to work with an illustrator,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to design the look of your cover and the look of the book.
Does the designer oversee not only the illustration but also the typeset as well, or is that part of the same package group?
There usually is a typesetter who specifically mm-hmm. does that, and I think that's working with the designer. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this team of specialists. I don't usually meet the typesetter.
If I
meet them, it's very brief. But what they're doing is so important, right? Mm-hmm. The look and feel of the text inside the book. I mean, that's kind of a big deal when you get into it. But it's a big, working with good illustrators and good designers to have covers that draw in a reader, that's a big deal. I mean, in some ways, it can make or break. Like when a new series is out, especially for the book ones,
mm-hmm.
and especially if you're a new writer. So much hinges on, does the cover appeal? Does it draw in the reader?
It seems like you have had, Brandon Dorman? Is he your main illustrator that you've used? Tell me a little bit about him, your relationship with him, and how important he's been to your team.
So the illustrator I've worked with the most is a guy named Brandon Dorman. And he got started about the same time as me. So mm-hmm. I was one of his very, I might have even been his first novel, or one of his very first novels that he illustrated for. Was Fablehaven Book 1. And he has gone on to be very successful. He's worked with, done a lot of the Land of Stories books with Chris Colfer, and he's done a lot of the Goosebumps books like R.L. Stine, especially as they recover a lot of them and stuff. And so, I mean, he's worked just, and that's just, that's a smattering, right? He's worked with a lot of big authors, a lot of big publishers. But I've had the honor of working with him since the start, and he's done, he did all my Fablehaven books, all my Dragon Watch books, all my Candy Shop War books. And he also, we did some picture books together. He did some of the ancillary books like The Caretaker's Guide to Fablehaven, which is just full of art. And, you know, he's all the art. And so, I mean, we've worked together on lots of projects. And so if there's a single illustrator whose work has given a visual identity to my work, it's him, right? Because he did so many of my books. Now, there's been a couple other very talented illustrators. Different people did Beyonders. Mm-hmm. Different people did Five Kingdoms. You know, and some of those books have done really well, and the illustrators were really talented. But the guy that I know personally the best is Brandon, partly because we've done so many things together, partly because we were starting out together and we got to know each other. So, I'll visit his house sometimes, or if I'm in town, I'll see him, or he'll come out for a book launch and be part of it, which doesn't happen with all the illustrators. Right. And I'm grateful that we've had so much overlap, because that collaboration, he was the guy who gave me a visual identity back when no one had ever heard my name, you know, in connection with writing books.
When I think of your brand, so much of it is visually created by Brandon, right?
Yeah,
and what he did. And I don't know if he did, I assume somebody else did the title treatment, or did he do title treatment as well?
No, yeah, like there's a designer named Richard Erickson, who actually passed away not too long ago.
Oh, no.
But he designed a lot of that stuff, worked with Brandon Dorman to get the title right.
And because it works so well together. And I know it's a different skill set, so that's why I assumed it was probably somebody different. But that, how your name is laid out on your books and stuff, that's part of like a brand that was created for you that's pretty awesome to have that type of support.
Yeah, I mean, they got even into, I think, designing their own font for my name. Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? Like there was lots of unique special touches and crafting that went into that a casual book consumer might not even think about, but where there's real choices and effort being made to create a brand and to create a feeling and an experience for holding the book and opening the book and what the font says about the author and the story and the experience you're going to have, you know, and when you get into it, there's a lot to think about. And I'm so grateful to have a team of people helping make those choices, or completely making those choices, and often making those choices and then saying, hey, does this work for you? And often I look at it and go, it's so much better than I could have ever done on my own. And I'm so glad there's a team here with specialists who can make this stuff happen.
Specialists and professionals who have a career doing this type of work. But that's not all that's on your team is the professionals. You also have non-professionals helping you on your team. Tell me about those individuals and how you use them in the work that you do.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are some key people who are not professionals and basically just for fun or for friendship or whatever, you know, out of fellowship have helped me with my books. And usually it's because they kind of like entertainment and they kind of like me and some mix of that because it's family members and it's you and it's, you know. But one of the things you look for as a writer is, you know, I think they call them now beta readers, you know, but basically you're looking for a couple of people whose judgment you trust to read early drafts and point out where you're going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this best explained to me actually by Orson Scott Card, who said, there's really only two things you want from a beta reader, generally speaking. He's like, you want them to point out if there's any place where they got bored.
Yeah.
And you want them to point out if there's anything they didn't understand. And generally speaking, if they point those two things out, What did you not understand why the character did this? Could you not see the scene? Did you not, like, where did it break down? Like, where did you lose? Because if two or three people didn't understand a certain scene,
there's an issue.
There's definitely an issue, right? You know, one person, it's like, check it. There might be an issue. But two or three, you're like, there's guaranteed an issue if two or three out of five stumbled here, right? Or if two or three out of five said, I started getting bored here. You're like, I got to tighten the pacing on that part, right? Now, I've also learned that there are people who have specialized superpowers, and you're one of them. And one of your specialized superpowers is you can see opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes you will, like more than any other reader that I give it to, including the professional editors in New York, you will sometimes see a couple of like kind of home run opportunities that I didn't see. And like, oh yeah, that would be a really good story. But you think like a story maker, right? And so, and there have been times when I've used those story opportunities you saw.
It's always exciting for me when I get one in that works. I know when I read your book for the purpose of providing feedback, I go in with a thought of what did he set up that he didn't pay off, right? Where are those things? And then my other thing that I always look for is what character lived that should have died. the two things. And I feel pretty, it feels great when you kill a character that I recommended that you killed. And I think I could think of a couple that has happened, or just those moments of big payoff. And it's funny when I read those, usually they don't come until I finish the book, because I don't know what's missing until the end there. So often I'm like, at the climax, I'm like, I don't have any notes for Brandon yet. And then usually at the end, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, we could do X, Y, or Z, or pitch that to him. And when it always stings and hurts is when you say, oh, that would have worked, but I have run out of time. I don't have any more time for to make a change that big.
A big enough change. Yeah. But there's sometimes where like, I think this was you in Beyonders. We had these seed men.
Yeah. The broken seed or the
to have
the
Drake, fault. Right?
Yeah. That was mine. Yeah.
And we had these guys with seeds so that we can catch up the audience. We had these guys that had seeds at the base of their skulls, and if you kill them, the seed pops out, and you can plant them, and they can grow again. Mm-hmm. And which grants them a form of immortality if that seed.
As long as it gets planted.
It gets planted, they grow, and they grow with a new seed. And if they die, it gets planted, and they grow again, and it preserves their memories, mm-hmm. and they can live on and on that way. And you had said, wouldn't that be interesting to have a character whose seed was malformed?
Yeah.
Like a birth defect. And he knew he was on his last life after living many lives. And I was just like, that was one of the most beautiful opportunities anyone's ever shared with me that I didn't think of myself. That like was just brilliant. That really like, I was like, oh, in that exception to the rule is mm-hmm. the most interesting character.
Yeah. You know, where it really defines the character and how precious life actually becomes when it's your last life.
Yeah. Like it's so funny because it's the same stakes that you and I live with.
We're already on our last life. We have defective seeds. We're not growing back.
But for some reason, somebody who's had these many, many lives, like, yeah, it gives us this great poignancy. Mm-hmm. And someone who maybe sometimes wasted a couple of those lives or spent them poorly to go, wow, this is the last one. What am I going to do with this last precious lifetime after so many? It was the character Drake, and it led to all sorts of great stuff. And so here's the thing. Your editor can do what your editor can do. Mm-hmm. But when you have a little bit of hive mind of some people with good creative judgment, it's a great way to catch and filter some extra things. I had an uncle who passed away, my Uncle Tuck, and gosh, I can't even talk about it.
Yeah,
I don't even know if I can, because it just sucks that he passed away, but he did every single book, and he did it so thoroughly. He would read it so carefully and thoroughly, and he would be so insanely thorough that probably 3/4 of the stuff he would give me was stuff that I didn't want, you know, because it was just like, yeah, I got my reasons why I did this. I got my reasons why I did that, and you're overthinking this. But in that other quarter of things were some stuff nobody else would catch that caught all sorts of little nuancy things that were really great, right? Mm-hmm. And like... And maybe 3/4 is too high, maybe half or whatever.
Sure.
But it was just that he would catch so much and have so many thoughts about it that even the stuff that I didn't take his advice on, it made me more deliberate mm-hmm. in my writing, because I said, no, I'm on purpose saying this, and maybe I can even clarify it and make it more on purpose, right? And so you had different, like you had him looking at the minutiae and really looking close. And you had guys like you who are looking broad. Mm-hmm. Then you have someone like my wife or Lynn who is just the best lay editor I've ever found, the best friend editor I've ever found, who's really good at pushing it to say what it means, both in mood and in tone. And like, she's really good at pulling out the actual intended meaning and getting it to say what it meant in a way that's better than anyone I've ever worked with. And she's like become like, I've had her for the last maybe 5 books or so. And she's like, my secret weapon now, you know, to have this editor who, like, it gets a very professional edit before it goes to the professional editor. And it's just such a huge help. And so finding a few readers who can give early feedback and who can kind of like help me shape it nicely before we get to the professional level edit, or sometimes even in connection with the professional level edit, has elevated all my work, my whole career. I look smarter than I am because I've had a couple good friends with smart minds that apply those minds to my work on my behalf. And there's almost no way to thank them enough, honestly, like to thank you enough.
Well, thanks for taking time today to talk about your team, talk about those people that are behind the scenes that have helped launch your career and keep you afloat there. I think sometimes we look at individuals in careers like writing and go, oh, they're by themselves. They have done this all on their own. And as much truth as there is in that statement, you're still supported by a team that you have to rely on to help. And I think that's good for people to learn.
It's really weird how much it is this solo sport, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like it is so alone so much. But its intent is to reach a lot of people. And without that team, unless you can be both a hermit and a man of the people, like you're going to miss out, right? Yeah. Like you got to try to wear both hats. And really, like, I mean, it comes down to teachers who share it with their kids, mm-hmm. librarians who share it with their patrons. Like there's this huge network of individuals who have shared it with family or friends that are actually the reason I can do it as a living, right? Yeah. It's such a job where it's friends telling friends that if I was to really speak to the team, it's anyone who's ever read the book and shared it. Mm-hmm. That's why it's my job. Because on my book tour, I've done enough to probably not even pay for the plane tickets of the book tour on the actual sales I make on tour. It's just if enough people hear about it and like it enough that they share it, that's how you make a living as a writer. And so anyone who's ever read the book and liked it or shared it, like you are really very legitimately on the team and the reason I'm able to do this full time.
Yeah. When you said a solo sport, I thought of boxing and I got all my information from boxing from the Rocky films. And I imagine that, you know, you're out there in the ring doing it, but you've got Mick, you've got your other coaches, you've got those people around you, even people to hold the bucket so you can spit the blood in and do stuff. So it's awesome to know that you not only have a team, but that you recognize and appreciate your team and all that they've done for you.
Yeah. Yeah. If it wasn't for that team, I'd be a lonely guy making up stories alone. That's what I would be.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I think that's a great note to end on. So we'll let you get back to your team.
All right.
Hey there, fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second, we don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.